is that the first phase of potential activity ought to be to create the conditions favoring the installation of chaos in all the regime structure. In our view, the first move should be to make it so to destroy the structures of the democratic state under the cover of communist and pro-Chinese activists. Moreover, we have people who have infiltrated these groups, and obviously we will have to tailor our actions to the ethos of the milieu, propaganda and actions of a sort which will seem to have emanated from our communist adversaries. That will create a feeling of hostility towards those who threaten the peace of each and every nation. And at the same time, we must raise up and defend our citizenry against the disintegration brought about by terrorism and subversion.
Italian judge Guido Salvini, who investigated the strategy of tension, found that Serac had indeed carried out the dark strategy of tension plans. He wrote,
"In 1975, the group of Guérin Serac, together with the American Salvi, and militant French, Italian, and Spanish rightists, organized a series of bomb attacks. The bombs were planted at Algerian embassies in four different countries, France, Germany, Italy, and Great Britain. In reality, the bombings were carried out by the group of Guérin Serac, who thus demonstrated his great camouflage and infiltration capabilities. The bomb in front of the Algerian embassy in Frankfurt did not blow up, and was meticulously analyzed by the German police. It is important to notice the complex fabrication of the bomb. It contains C4, an explosive exclusively used by the US forces, which has never been used in any of the anarchist bombings."
These statements by and about Guérin Serac provide undeniable evidence of the fact that secret armies in Western Europe engaged in terrorist killings of innocent civilians to achieve political objectives. These secret armies, as we have seen, operated with guidance from the CIA and NATO, hence from US intelligence and military officers. I turn now to the question of strategy of tension operations in the United States itself. The United States. In the United States, the strategy of tension was predominantly advocated in the early 1960s by the highest-ranking officer in the Pentagon, General Lyman Lemnitzer, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, as a pretext to convince the U.S. public of the need to invade Cuba and overthrow Castro. Lemnitzer, who died in 1988, had been one of the senior officers sent to negotiate the Italian surrender in 1943 and the German surrender in 1945. After fighting in Korea, he became, in 1960, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Following the CIA's failed Bay of Pigs invasion in 1961, leading generals in the Pentagon, including Lemnitzer, argued that strategy of tension technique should be used against the U.S. population in order to create a pretext for war. Under the name Operation Northwoods, they developed a set of combined strategy of tension operations designed to shock the U.S. public and discredit Castro. At the time, President John F. Kennedy and his Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, opposed such operations, which included killing U.S. citizens, and involved a large-scale manipulation of the American population. Lemnitzer's plan was, accordingly, not implemented. As with most strategy of tension operations, many years went by before the public learned of Operation Northwoods. Thanks to distinguished U.S. researcher James Bamford, the formerly top-secret Operation Northwoods documents became known to the public in April 2001, some months before the 9/11 terrorist attacks, when Bamford published his book Body of Secrets, An Anatomy of the Ultra-Secret National Security Agency. This was 40 years after the Northwood plans had been stamped top secret inside the Pentagon. The original documents are now available online. The Operation Northwoods documents specify how the Pentagon planned strategy of tension operations, Among other actions, the US officers suggested developing a fake communist Cuban terror campaign in the Miami area, in other Florida cities, and even in Washington, faking a Cuban Air Force attack on a civilian jetliner, sinking a boatload of Cuban refugees, real or simulated, and concocting a Remember the Maine incident by blowing up a US ship in Cuban waters and then blaming the incident on Cuban sabotage. Ever since Bamford published the Operation Northwoods documents, those interested in the strategy of tension have wondered how far certain radical groups within the Pentagon were willing to go and what chance the US public and other nations had of discovering and stopping such plans. Bamford wondered whether Operation Northwoods was the most corrupt plan ever created by the US government, or whether the Gulf of Tonkin incident of 1964, the incident that provoked America's full-fledged war in Vietnam, which led to the deaths of 56,000 U.S. soldiers and 3 million Vietnamese, had been a typical strategy of tension operation designed and carried out by the Pentagon.
In light of the Operation Northwoods documents,
Bamford concluded,
it is clear that deceiving the public and trumping up wars for Americans to fight and die in was standard, approved policy at the highest levels of the Pentagon.
Conclusion. The two main arguments against the view that the attacks of 9/11 were influenced by the US government and its military have been a priori arguments. One of these is that civilized Western governments in general, and the US government in particular, would never do such a heinous thing. The other main a priori argument is that if the attacks of 9/11 were carried out by forces within America's own government, this fact could not have remained secret for long. The information in this article shows both of these arguments to be dubious at best. No overview of the European deep state would be complete without mention at least of the Bilderberg Group, a highly secretive, invitation-only set of annual meetings held since 1954 for political leaders, CEOs of companies, media corporations, intelligence leaders. But we have covered that on the show before. Episode 528 is devoted to the topic. Now, what you may not know, unless you've kept up with recent events, is that almost all the Bilderberg attendee lists have now been published, which helps to decipher what they had a hand in. And anyway, the Bilderberg is much more widely known than a number of smaller and more secretive groups which I've discovered whilst researching for Wikispooks. We're going to hear an article about one of them, Le Cercle. It's more secretive, it's smaller, it's rumoured, strongly suspected to be CIA-funded, it's another organ of the deep state, allowing intelligence agency chiefs, deep state actors, to decide what they're going to prioritize, allowing them to coordinate internationally, formerly in complete secrecy. And now there's so much information coming online that it's actually possible to get an overview, and a picture is emerging of what these guys were up to. So there is a fairly good page on Wikispooks, which I shall link from this show's webpage, and this is one of the documents that we find there by researcher David Teacher, and it was first published in 1989. The Pinay Circle and the Destabilization of Europe begins with three speakers from a closed session of the Bavarian Parliament's Committee of Investigation into the Langemann Affair in June 1982. Quote, Member of Parliament G. I don't know if the Pinay Circle has any political significance, but in any case it has little impact. For me, it seems to have been a collection of elderly gentlemen doddering around, a few elderly gentlemen sitting over cups of coffee and discussing world developments. What do these fellows want? Member of Parliament A. These are no elderly gentlemen. They are former CIA and BND people working together. Member of Parliament X. I feel it is dangerous if we publicize such things. If such matters were to become public, it would damage the general image of the Federal Republic. Therefore, we will decide to remove references of any kind to other countries or to connections with state services. Unquote. When Dr. Hans Langemann blew the whistle on a series of dubious BND, that's Bundesnachrichtendienst Federal Intelligence Service, the German Secret Service, operations to Concrete magazine in 1982, he opened up a whole can of worms whose ramifications could go well beyond Germany's borders. His evidence was unassailable. From 1957 to 1970, Langemann was one of the BND's highest-ranking officers. In 1972, he was security chief for the Munich Olympics, before being purged by the SPD government for being too close to Franz Josef Strauß's Christian Social Union Party. Langemann then became top link man for the security and intelligence services within the Bavarian Interior Ministry. It was their confidential documents he passed to Konkret in 1982. Published in Spiegel at the time and reproduced in Lobster No. 17, the documents give external confirmation of the conspiracy to effect change of government in Britain and reveal the European and worldwide links of this conspiracy through the Pinay Circle. The Pinay Circle, also called Le Cercle Violet, is an international right-wing propaganda group which brings together serving or retired intelligence officers and politicians with links to right-wing intelligence factions from most of the countries in Europe. The intelligence community has been represented by SIS, that's MI6, chief from 1978 to 82, Arthur Dickey Franks, SIS department head Nicholas Elliott, CIA director William Colby, Swiss Military Intelligence Chief of Provisions Colonel Botta, SDECE Chief from 1970 to 81 Alexandre de Morange, and last but not least, the man who took over the running of the circle when Pinay got too old, Jean Violet, a Parisian lawyer who worked for the SDECE from 1957 to 1970. Violet so much an éminence grise in the SDECE that Alexandre de Morange had to dispense with his services in order to assert his authority as the new SDECE chief in 1970. This episode has, however, not prevented them from working together within the circle. At the time the Langemann papers were written, Franks and Morange were serving heads of British and French intelligence, respectively. On the political side, Pinay, a former French prime minister, formed links with Nixon, Kissinger, and Pompidou. The circle's present members include Giulio Andreotti, the former Italian prime minister, Portuguese putschist General Antonio de Spinola, former Franco minister and senior Opus Dei member Silva Munoz, and Vatican prelate and BND agent Monsignore Brunello. Paul Violet, Jean Violet's son, is one of Chirac's closest advisers, nicknamed the Adjutant by Canard Enchaine. Langemann also reports that Sir Arthur Franks and Nicholas Elliott were invited to Chequers for a working meeting with Mrs. Thatcher after her election. But perhaps the key political figure was the late Franz Josef Strauß, Bavarian premier and Langemann's boss. Strauss was a close friend of Alexandre de Morange and was a frequent visitor to the SDECE headquarters during Morange's time. The Hans Seidel Stiftung, the political trust attached to the Strauss's Christian Social Union Party, is an important group in international parapolitical manipulation. Active in Latin America for the Contras, supporting Mobutu in Zaire, involved in the Fiji coup in 1987, it was caught diverting state development aid from Germany into right-wing party coffers in Ecuador in the same year. Strauss and the CSU were the main beneficiaries of identified Pinay Circle activities, i.e. the promotion of right-wing European politicians through Brian Crozier, Robert Moss, Fred Luxinger of the Neue Zürcher Zeitung, and Gerhard Löwenthal, anchorman on current news affairs programs for ZDF Television, the major German network. The Pinay Circle has a wide range of contacts, and its members interlock with the whole panoply of right-wing and parallel intelligence and propaganda agencies. WACL, Heritage Foundation, Western Goals, ISC, Freedom Association, Interdoc, the Bilderberg Group, the Jonathan Institute, P2, Opus Dei, the Moonies Front, CAUSA, IGFM, that's the International Society for Human Rights, and Resistance International. Löwenthal, for instance, is a member of IGFM, Resistance International, WACL, CAUSA, the Jonathan Institute, Conservative Action, and the European Institute on Security. The Pinay Circle's significance lies in the fact that it's a forum which brings together the international link men of the right, like Crozier, Moss, Löwenthal, with Secret Service chiefs like Franks and Maroche. Through such contacts, it can intervene by media action or covert funding whenever and wherever a political friend is in need of support. The Langemann Papers date from late 1979, so they do not reveal to what extent the Pinay Circle was playing the last act in the Thatcher conspiracy. But Langemann's November 1979 report stated, "Specific aims within this framework are to effect a change of government, 1. In the United Kingdom, accomplished, 2. In West Germany, to defend freedom of trade and of movement, and to oppose all forms of subversion, including terrorism." The international promotion of the Bavarian premier was discussed in the circle's January 1980 meeting. In a follow-up meeting in June the same year, the circle's attention was turned towards the American presidential election that was to bring Reagan to power. The minutes of the meeting of the Pinay Circle held on the 28th and 29th of June 1980 in Zurich. A further meeting of the circle was held under the chairmanship of Violet, attended by those present at the previous meeting, including Colonel Botter of the Swiss Intelligence Service and Fred Luxinger, head of the Neue Zürcher Zeitung. Quote, 1. The prospects for positive influence on the election campaign in favour of Strauss cannot be judged to be very favourable. While the many promotional influences in the US, UK and Swiss newspapers were welcomed by their readers, their impact on the Federal Republic lagged far behind. Furthermore, it seems doubtful that Strauss will be able to match the dynamic foreign policy initiatives that Federal Chancellor Schmidt has been able to make, in contrast to the situation in the US, where President Carter is confronted with the shattered remains of his foreign policy, difficult to present favourably for the election campaign, even in part. Schmidt has understood how to make clear and prominent political steps which represent an achievable goal for the population's desire for peace. Luxinger said that he was prepared to produce a series of 3 leading articles highlighting the tendency of current government policy in Bonn to weaken NATO. Crozier felt that similar steps could be tried again through Moss in London and the Baltimore Sun in the US. 2. Graf Huing reported on his meeting with the head of the Saudi Security Service about the establishment of a shortwave radio transmitting towards the Soviet Union. The Saudis were interested, he said, and guaranteed finance on the condition that a situation such as that created in Moscow by Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty must be avoided at all cost. 3. A discussion was held about a series of appropriate measures to promote the electoral campaign of presidential candidate Reagan against Carter. Elliot reported that in this context, positive contact had been made with George Bush as well. 4. Colonel Botter stated that, in his opinion, support must be given to the Israeli intelligence service. It was noted that, as far as Europe was concerned, the efficiency of this service had diminished considerably. Unquote. The contacts in 1980 between George Bush and ex-MI6 and Circle member Nicholas Elliott are even more interesting now that Bush has made it to the top. But perhaps the most significant element in the Langerman papers is the illustration of the international dimension of parapolitical manipulation represented by the Circle's promotional activities. It's becoming more and more apparent that the treatment reserved for Harold Wilson at the hands of the intelligence services was only the UK end of an international phenomenon. Around 1973-75, a surprising number of governments were targeted by their own or others' intelligence agencies because of their radical policies. If the world political scene in the 1960s was one of decolonization, then the 1970s was the decade of destabilization. Among those cases of destabilization we are already aware of are the UK. The concerted effort by elements of British intelligence and security services, with the CIA and BOS, that's the South African Secret Service, to bring down Wilson, Thorpe and Heath. The USA, the CIA's Operation Chaos, the FBI's COINTELPRO program, and of course, Watergate. Australia, the loan scandal, another destabilization of Gough Whitlam by the CIA and MI6. West Germany, the destabilization of Willy Brandt because of his overture to the other Germany through Ostpolitik. The CIA and MI5 suspected Brandt of having been recruited by Moscow during his wartime service with the resistance in Scandinavia. Reflecting on the Pinay Circle and its apparent role as European coordinator of media manipulation, several other avenues for investigation come to mind. In the UK, the role of Arthur Dickey Franks. Before the publication of the Langerman papers in 1982, Frank's only known connection to the Wilson story was his central role in circulating the typescript of the Pincher Wright book, Their Trade is Treachery, around Whitehall in 1980. It was Frank's, as MI6 chief, who warned MI5 and MI6 of Pincher's forthcoming publication. His letter, dated 15th of December 1980, was produced as evidence in the Spycatcher trial. The Langerman papers show that Franks had a far more active role than simply a channel for backdoor clearance for Wright's leaks. It is astounding that no British newspaper has ever investigated Spiegel's 1982 revelation that the serving head of British intelligence was a member of a covert propaganda group whose stated aim was, quote, to effect a change of government in the UK, unquote, and which claimed that this had been accomplished. Nicholas Elliott's name had also not previously surfaced in reports of destabilizations. In MI6 counterintelligence, with postings in Bern, Istanbul, London and Beirut, it was Elliott who confronted Kim Philby in Beirut in 1963, sparking Philby's flight to the Soviet Union. Apart from his Pinay Circle activities, Elliott is also a council member for the Wilkinson McWhirter Ivens Group, the research foundation for the study of terrorism. Elliott's memoirs are among the numerous works by former intelligence officers listed in The Guardian, June 6, 1989, which the government will not permit to be published. In France, 1974, François Mitterrand made his first attempt to unseat the Republicans who had ruled France since the foundation of the Fifth Republic, losing narrowly to Pompidou's successor, Valéry Giscard d'Estaing. The man who controlled French intelligence under Pompidou and Giscard from 1970 to 1981 was Alexandre de Meringe, one of the Circle and a friend of Franz Josef Strauss. In 1978, Le Monde alleged that, quote, under Meringe's leadership, terrorism and also disinformation, the influencing of public opinion, were extensively pursued by the SDECE, unquote. Was there a French connection to the mid-1970s destabilizations? Certainly, when Mitterrand finally beat Giscard in 1981, Marange resigned on the spot, and the Action Service rebelled. The role of Chirac also needs to be clarified. He was Prime Minister under Giscard from 1974 on, and liaised with Marange, Giscard's spymaster, on many matters, including the sale of nuclear technology to Iraq. Marange and Chirac are further linked through the person of Michel Roussin, who liaised between the SDECE and the Prime Minister's office from 1972 to 76. Roussin rose to become Marange's Directeur du Cabinet, and as such accompanied the SDECE chief on a last-minute trip to Tehran in 1979 to warn the Shah of the impending Islamic Revolution. After being removed from the SDECE in 1982 by Marange's successor, the socialist appointee Pierre Marion, Roussin moved over to become Chirac's chef de cabinet, putting his previous experience of Iran to good use as operational head of Chirac's 1987 hostages cell. Also in on the 1979 Tehran trip was the SDECE's expert named in Marange's memoirs as Captain M. Gould. Could this be Captain Jean-Charles Marchiani, who negotiated the hostages' release in Beirut for Chirac? If so, Chirac's hostages' cell was no less than the key officers from Marange's SDECE Iran desk in 1979. Marchiani had previously been involved in two of the dirtier episodes of SDECE history. He'd become a member of a four-man Section 6, which dealt with honourable correspondence, most notable example Jean Violet, that was implicated in the 1970 smear of President Pompidou's wife, the Markovic affair, and the 1971 Delouette affair, when an SDECE agent of that name was caught smuggling 44 kilos of heroin into the US. Apart from the fact that Marchiani was Delouette's handler, the man who supplied Delouette with the heroin was Marchiani's cousin, Dominique Mariani. The heroin was apparently to be sold to finance SDECE operations in the United States. The SDECE unit compromised by both scandals, Section 6, was widely thought to be hostile to Pompidou because he'd betrayed General de Gaulle. Certainly, in the subsequent investigation, it emerged that Section 6 was close to the Gaullist parallel police, the Service d'Action Civique, founded by Charles Pasqua, Chirac's interior minister, in 1987 an overall head of the hostages' cell. Chirac's links to Paul Violet may also be a lead for future investigation. Sweden. Olof Palme. Franz Josef Strauss, a key member of the circle, set the tone for Pinay Circle concerns when he said, quote, "We stand before a decisive year, a fateful year in world history. The Reds in power in Moscow know that too. It's not surprising that their pawns in the West, the socialists, so-called Euro-communists, strive so determinedly to hold their positions. Brandt's protégé, Philippe González, spreads disruption in Spain, financed by millions from the coffers of a socialist mafia trio, Brandt, Kreisky and Palme." Unquote. Was Palme the victim of a destabilization attempt in the mid-1970s, like fellow socialist Willy Brandt? Is there a connection to the most plausible of Palme murder theories, action by a right-wing faction within the Swedish intelligence service, SAPO? In 1973, three journalists alleged the existence of such a group within the 03 department of the service, a faction which carried out dirty tricks against radical and anti-Vietnam groups, incited Palestinians living in Sweden to violence, and conducted smear campaigns on behalf of prominent members of the Social Democrat hierarchy. In 1987, the leading Swedish daily paper, Dagens Nyheter, carried an article by Bjarne Möbel, which alleged that 03 had organized, if not carried out, the 1986 Palma killing, angered at his policy of détente towards the Soviet Union, or perhaps fearful that Palma would uncover and expose the true extent of the Bofors arms deals with Iran and implicate them. There have also been allegations of Sapo manipulation of the murder inquiry. The entire Kurdish trail, which fruitlessly occupied the Swedish police for over 2 years, could have been a red herring laid by Sapo to lead the investigators away from domestic culprits. Self-preservation for Sapo is alleged to be behind the Ebba Karlsson affair, in which two Sapo officers, Walter Kego and Jan-Erik Barling, were involved in the secret continuation of investigations into possible Kurdish origins of the Palma murder. Sanctioned by Justice Minister Anna-Greta Leijon, the two officers assisted a friend of the minister's, Ebba Karlsson, in illegally obtaining surveillance equipment to continue investigations into the Kurdish PKK after the investigation had officially been abandoned. When customs discovered Sapo agent Per Ola Karlsson with the equipment, the balloon went up. In the ensuing Ebba Karlsson affair, Minister Leijon, the head of the National Police and head of Sapo, Per Koran Nas, all lost their jobs. As a result, impending legislation sponsored by Leijon to bring Sapo under firm political control collapsed. Le Monde of 5th of June 1989 commented, quote, "The discovery of this private inquiry exposed the struggle which had been going on for over 20 years between the Social Democratic Party and a faction within the Secret Service, which is undoubtedly beyond government control." Unquote. In any case, it is certain that the conviction of a small-time criminal and addict is a smokescreen with no intelligence or direct evidence save that of Palmer's wife to show more than that he was a convenient scapegoat, the only delinquent who could be proved to be in the area at the time. Belgium. Was there a coup d'etat in 1973? Issue 17 of Celsius devotes 6 pages to the study of a coup d'etat planned by gendarmerie officers and extreme right-wing groups in 1973. The article, "The Big Bad Look of the 1970s, the Destabilization of the State," is based on the confessions of Marshal Lecoeur, a former gendarme who fled to the USA when sought for questioning in the Killers of Brabant Wallon inquiry. The killers, who specialized in holding up supermarkets with maximum violence and minimum loot, killed 28 people between 1982 and 1985, always attacking the same chain of supermarkets on the same day of the week with the same kind of car, needlessly gunning people down, and then escaping with cash, rarely more than a few £1,000s. Lecoeur stated what many suspected: the killers were part of a political psyops campaign aimed at reinforcing the state structures. Whether there is a link between the 1973 coup plans and the 1980s destabilizations remains to be seen. Various parliamentary inquiries and commissions have so far failed to get to the bottom of the affair. So, did the destabilization go further than suspected, including France, Sweden and Belgium? What role did the Pinay Circle play in the early 1970s? Unfortunately, apart from the 1972 memo published in Lobster 17, the only Circle documents we have are the Langemann ones, from 1979 to 1980. Perhaps Lobster's European readers will come up with some information. And I'm pleased to say that they did. In 2011, Joel van der Leyden, a WikiSpooks member and deep political researcher, found and published 5 invitation lists to Cercle meetings. So that has formed the basis of the first successful look at who actually attends these meetings. Now, on the central assertion of the Langemann papers, for me, the key point is that a top German secret agent publishes this document of the Circle, which says They had an operation, quote, to effect a change of government in the United Kingdom, accomplished, unquote. In November 1979, that can only mean putting Margaret Thatcher in power. Now, what evidence do we have that such a project was carried out? Well, Brian Crozier, not a name I knew before I looked into this, chairman of Le Cercle for 5 years, a man who had his own private intelligence agency. Perhaps you thought that was just governments. Well, you may look up the 61 to learn more about that operation. Before he started that, he started a group called the Shield Committee, a small, tightly knit group with strong intelligence agency connections. Now, that was formed in 1976 and dissolved soon after Margaret Thatcher was elected to power. Now, our primary source for this is not a whistleblower or a leaked document, but a 1993 article in the London Times entitled A Secret Shield for the Lady by Brian Crozier himself. The Shield Committee produced a report that said MI6 is in good shape, MI5 needs to be thoroughly reorganized or possibly abolished. And is it just coincidence that Airey Neave, a close friend of Margaret Thatcher and her campaign manager for her successful bid to lead the Conservative Party, was assassinated by a car bomb in the House of Commons just a few weeks before he would have had a chance to put his plans into action? And, incidentally, just 8 days after the assassination of Richard Sykes, reportedly tipped to be his second-in-command. Now, if the powers that be are to be believed, responsibility for both of those bombings was claimed by Irish terrorists. Now, it seems to me very likely that somebody called somebody and said, oh, those bombings, yeah, that was us, we're Irish terrorists. Quite what that actually means, who knew those attacks were underway, who ordered them to occur, I think we would be very well advised to remain circumspect about that. Suspicious old person that I am these days, when I saw all those names of Cercle attendees in front of me, I thought, I wonder, what does WikiSpooks already have to tell us about what these people have got up to? So I had a bit of a nose and found my way to the Al Yamama arms deal, the largest arms deal in British history, the first tranche of which, involving over 100 jets, the exact price remains a secret. It was also worked out in oil, complicated deal, somewhere between £40 and £50 billion, signed by Michael Heseltine in 1985. He was Defence Secretary. Now, earlier that month, none other than Norman Lamont had got a junior job in the Ministry of Defence. He was Minister for Defence Procurement. And Norman Lamont went on to chair the Cercle for over a decade. Now, the second tranche of the Al Yamama arms deal, signed in 1993 for another 48 Tornado fighter jets to Saudi Arabia, was set up largely by the then UK Minister for Defence Procurement, one Jonathan Aitken. Now, I can't conclusively state that he was chairman of Le Cercle while he was Defence Procurement Minister, but there is quite a lot of evidence for this. He certainly was chairman of Le Cercle, if not during that, but then very soon after he left that job. Now, you won't perhaps be surprised to hear that after retiring his cabinet positions, he was quickly appointed as a representative for an arms company, GEC Marconi. You might be perhaps more surprised to hear that he did actually get convicted for receiving bribes in connection with the Al Yamama arms deal. Students of the arms trade in the UK may perhaps also recall another affair called the Arms to Iraq business. That was a weapons deal to Iraq at that stage with an ongoing war against Iran, and there were statutes in place to say you're not allowed to sell weapons to this country. Clearly, with a war going on, you could expect to make some pretty hefty profits from selling weapons. And again, perhaps this is just coincidence, but Circle attendees Paul Channon and Alan Clark were connected to that affair. And Alan Clark was Minister for Defence Procurement again for 3 years. He left in April 1992, succeeded by his fellow Circle member, Jonathan Aitken. Now, legal action in the case of the Arms to Iraq affair was stymied by deployment of public interest immunity certificates. These appear to be a tool by the establishment if matters are coming dangerously close to being exposed. All it needs is powerful people to say, well, that's not in the national interest. This is a matter of national security, and therefore ordinary procedures are suspended. No judge, no lawyers, no, you can't have that evidence. You've got to take that back. So that's Arms to Iraq. And if you're not familiar with the Al-Yamama arms deal, I'll flesh out a few more connections. It was signed by Prince Bandar, whose name we've heard in connection with 9/11 and Al-Qaeda. He was Saudi ambassador to America for a couple of decades, and later head of the Saudi Secret Service. He had a few questions to answer as far as his role in receiving large amounts of money paid to a bank in Washington, and he sought the legal representation of a man named Louis Free, whom you may remember was the second longest serving director of the FBI. In the UK in 1994, an MP, Tam Dalyell, submitted documents that he said proved Mark Thatcher had made £12 million in commission on the deal signed by his mum, and the legal authorities decided that they wouldn't investigate that. By 2004, the Serious Fraud Office had decided to start investigating the Al-Yamama deal, and that came to a sudden end. A couple of years later, the end of 2006, they were just about to get a whole bunch of Swiss bank account details when suddenly the intervention of the Saudis led to Tony Blair writing a personal and secret memo to the Attorney General instructing him that the investigation must be terminated forthwith. And The Guardian quotes an unnamed document from the Serious Fraud Office in which the UK ambassador to Saudi Arabia warned of a risk to, quote, British lives on British streets, and added ominously, quote, if this caused another 7/7, how could we say our investigation is more important, unquote. Now, a couple of years later, that termination of the investigation was ruled illegal, but the current official narrative states that at some time between May and October 2012, the Serious Fraud Office lost 32,000 pages of documents and 81 audio tapes linked to that bribery probe. So, with all that money sloshing around just from that one deal, some sources suggesting as high as $6 billion worth of money went missing, probably ended up in Swiss bank accounts of various key players. One could see how the issue about whether the Circle is funded from the US or from elsewhere becomes pretty much a moot point. The official narrative is that it's privately funded. Self-funded might be another way to look at it. But we're lacking official documentation and whistleblowers from recent years, so let's return to destabilization of Europe in the 70s and 80s, as this interview from Euronews in 2008 reminds us. False flag attacks on civilians were only one of various strategies employed to try to control electoral politics.
30 years ago this month, the extreme left terrorist group the Red Brigades murdered former Italian Prime Minister Aldo Moro, who they'd kidnapped and held for nearly 2 months. Moro was the head of the Christian Democratic Party, which was moving towards a parliamentary coalition with the Italian communists, something opposed by some in the far left and which worried Western powers, particularly the US. Italy's interior minister at the time was Francesco Cossiga, who took a hard line and refused to negotiate with the Red Brigades for Moro's release. In an interview with Kosiga, Euronews has tried to get at the truth of an incredibly tangled tale involving allegations of CIA involvement and claims of vital clues sent via a Ouija board. You've been accused of refusing to negotiate with the Red Brigades because you actually wanted Moreau to be killed.
Why would I have wanted Moreau's death? If I hadn't refused to negotiate, the state would have collapsed and we would have found ourselves in a crisis, which would have been very difficult to get out of. And on top of that, I was nothing compared to someone like Moreau.
There are some who say that as long as Kosiga and Andreotti are alive, the truth about what really happened with Moreau will never be known.
There are some who don't want to accept this one thing, that Aldo Moreau was killed by the Red Brigades. Some in the former Christian Democratic Party, who turned Moreau into an icon, a left-winger, an enemy of the United States, they don't want to accept that Moreau was killed by people from the left. It must inevitably be that he was killed by the right, by the Americans, by the CIA. Otherwise, it just doesn't work for them.
You never believed Italian politician Romano Prodi's explanation that he heard the name of the street where Moreau was held at a séance. Why would Prodi lie about that?
He didn't lie. He said that because he didn't want to reveal his sources, especially at a time like that. But even now, if he revealed who told him, I don't know how long his informant would remain alive. He and the others invented this story of a séance and words spelled out on a Ouija board to be able to make the information public and protect their source.
A U.S. hostage negotiator, Steve Pesnik, who was brought to Italy by you to advise on getting Moreau released, has said that a statement supposedly from the Red Brigades that Moreau's body was in Lake Duquesa, 100 kilometers north of Rome, was false and put out by the government. He implied that that statement was intended to test what Italian public opinion would be to Moreau's death.
It's important to note that after the Lake Duquesa message, the resistance to negotiating weakened considerably. It was then that the leaders of the Christian Democratic Party, including me, who had decided on this tough no-negotiation policy, changed their approach. It was then that the socialists started negotiations. The socialists did not trust us and wanted to carry out the negotiations on their own. If they had talked to me about who they made contact with, we would probably have been able to find where Moreau was being held.
In France, the so-called Mitterrand doctrines, under which Italian far-left activists who fled to France were not extradited, seems no longer to be in place. Is France collaborating with Italy over the extradition of alleged terrorists?
You want my opinion. So many years have passed. You know I'm the person who was branded a Nazi and accused of being responsible for torture and ordering killings and lots worse. I always felt there should be a blanket amnesty, that we should draw a line under the whole period, when it was almost like a civil war, rather than reviewing the individual cases.
One of those France wouldn't extradite was novelist Cesare Battisti. Is he also a murderer?
He's both. Being one doesn't exclude being the other. It's as if you'd asked me if Caravaggio was a major painter or a violent man who killed someone in a bar fight. He's one and the same.
Outside Italy, Berlusconi's election victory has been greeted with irony, scorn, even some embarrassment. Are those other countries being snobbish, or is Italy really an anomaly?
The first person to telephone him was Spain's Prime Minister Zapatero. The second, who reacted enthusiastically, was Wilfried Martens, the president of the centre-right European People's Party. Tony Blair, who was in Rome at the time, met with the left-wingers Massimo D'Alema, Walter Veltroni, and Francesco Rutelli. But who did he have dinner with? Mr. Berlusconi. And it's important to note that I didn't vote for him. And you must keep in mind, I know the English. They're extremely snobbish.
Tenga presente che io conosco bene gli inglesi, sono estremamente snob.
You said the exclusion of the radical left from Parliament could create the right conditions for terrorism to reappear. Are there any indications that could happen?
The radical left took the extreme left as its reference point. I remember a big rally in Genoa in memory of Carlo Giuliani, the anti-G8 demonstrator shot dead by police in 2001, a gathering which was addressed by the Senate leader, Bertinotti. He gave a very rousing speech and was enthusiastically received. The police did not intervene, and at the end Bertinotti said, "Now everyone stay calm and go home," and there was no trouble. But these days, who would say something like that to them? Beltroni or Rutelli? Beltroni, who's known as an admirer of Kennedy, Bill Clinton and Obama? Or Rutelli, who's the spokesman for the Italian Episcopal Conference? You think they'd listen to them? Dream on.
Now, we focused particularly on Italy, for obvious reasons that that is where these killings were the most blatant and therefore have been subject to the most extensive investigations. But the killing of political leaders is not exclusively an Italian phenomenon. So now I wonder if you can guess, for our last piece, why I chose 1986 as the nominal end date for this show. I don't know if I'll ever do a successor to this. I haven't got a lot of recent material on the European deep state. That's still got to be organized and researched. But if you spotted that 1986 was the date in which Olof Palme was murdered, then congratulations on that. This really deserves a whole show of its own. It's still unsolved as far as I'm concerned. So rather than give you somebody's interpretation, let's have a listen to what was given for public consumption. And notice that in the first 30 seconds, we're told that police do not suspect that the killer had a motive. Now, that would surely be, in any other crime, a rather unexpected assumption, wouldn't it? I wonder whether you can think of any possible motives by listening to a couple of minutes more of the details of what they have to say about him.
This is LWT. Now, the news.
Swedish police have launched their biggest manhunt for the gunman who assassinated the country's prime minister late last night. Mr. Olof Palme was shot in the back while walking home unguarded with his wife after going to the cinema. Police now believe the same bullet that killed the prime minister grazed his wife. They say they don't suspect a political motive, but they have no strong clues to the killer's identity. They think it could be the work of a madman.
Police cordoned off the area where Mr. Palmer and his wife Lisbeth were strolling when the assassin struck. Two eyewitnesses saw the killer, a man in his 30s, as he escaped down a side street. Mr. Palmer and his wife were taken to a nearby hospital in the city centre. But just before midnight, he was pronounced dead. Mrs. Palmer has since been allowed home. Police have launched the biggest manhunt Sweden's ever seen, but so far they've no idea who the killer is or what his motive was. The new acting Prime Minister, Ingvar Carlsson, was heavily flanked by police when he met journalists today, and security's been stepped up around the Swedish king.
It came as a personal shock, as a friend who passed away brutally in a close area in Stockholm, which I really didn't thought this could happen.
As news of the killing spread, ordinary people turned up at the scene of the assassination. The Swedes have been stunned by this, the first political murder in their country in modern times. Their leader had been acclaimed universally as a man of peace.
The Queen has sent a message of sympathy to the King of Sweden. Mrs. Thatcher said Mr. Palmer's loss will be felt throughout the world. And the Labour leader, Mr. Kinnock, said the world should weep for Mr. Palmer's death.
Disbelief and shock. I suppose the kind of feelings that anyone would have if they heard that a dear friend had met a violent death. But it's also a feeling of immense loss, not just for myself and for all our friends everywhere, but for the people of the world. He was a man of the world and for the world in everything he did and said.
The SDP leader, Dr. David Owen, said Mr. Palmer's contribution to peace will be extremely hard to replace.
Sweden has lost a prime minister of great distinction in tragic circumstances. The world has lost a statesman of quite unique caliber, particularly in his pursuit of peace, whether East and West, in nuclear disarmament, or in the Third World, in ending conflicts. And I, as somebody who served under him on the Palme Commission on Disarmament, have lost a valued friend.
The Swedish ambassador heard about his prime minister's death on the radio. He'd known the man well since 1958.
I would say he was the best-known, internationally best-known politicians in Sweden today. And, of course, one of the most impressive politicians I have met in my life. And then to a very warm personality, a good personal friend.
Palmer was from a wealthy and aristocratic family, but became a leader of the Socialist International. He believed in what he called active neutrality. During the Vietnam War, he gave asylum to American draft dodgers and said the American bombing campaign was like the Nazi massacres. But he also condemned the Soviet-led invasion of Czechoslovakia.
Now, one might think, this is clearly a man of principle. How could anybody want to oppose a guy like that? And I suspect some people may have interpreted it that way. I read it rather differently. Could it be his track record of standing up for what he believed in, whatever other people said, threatened, exposing wrongdoing wherever he saw it? Could it be that that integrity was exactly what marked him out as somebody who couldn't be controlled, bribed, threatened, blackmailed, and therefore somebody who was going to pose a problem? There's a parallel here with John Perkins, who notes that Third World leaders who had established a reputation for standing up for the good of their people, who were actually doing their job, Jaime Roldos of Ecuador and Omar Torrijos of Panama, he mentions in particular, who were assassinated because they stood in the way of the World Bank and the IMF's plans for debt enslavement of the populace. So perhaps that syndrome is actually a worldwide phenomenon, and it's not a matter of third world countries and first world countries operating differently, but that there are organized groups who carry out their Machiavellian plans and who have managed to keep secret a large amount of control over the nominally altruistic state apparatus, which purports and still persuades a lot of people that it actually operates and is intended to operate for the public good. If you're feeling a little depressed by this show, I'll conclude with the following observation, that as this network continues to get exposed, and I can't see that changing with all that we see on the horizon for information technology, it seems to me that people's prospects in the longer term of doing one thing and saying another, of lying about what they've done in the past, these are 20th century thoughts, not 21st century thoughts. And as that becomes clear, then honesty becomes the best policy, even if it wasn't before. Because, and I'm quite clear on this, most people are not happy with this way of life. Most people don't want to be ruled in this fashion. A vast machine to perpetuate hopelessness, as David Graeber calls it, seems to me to be becoming an intolerable burden on the world in general and humankind in particular. This and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests are available for download from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. I'm still looking for volunteers to do readings, so, especially if you have a foreign accent, I'd encourage you to get in touch, unwelcome@unwelcomeguests.net, and offer your services to help produce a show.